Welcome to Free Thoughts from Libertarianism.org and the Cato Institute. I'm Aaron Ross Powell, editor of Libertarianism.org and a research fellow here at the Cato Institute.
And I'm Trevor Burrus, a research fellow at the Cato Institute Center for Constitutional Studies.
Joining us today is Bill Glaude, Program Officer of Philosophy at the Institute for Humane Studies. He holds a PhD in philosophy from Tulane University. Today we're going to be talking about libertarian paternalism, but let me start maybe a little bit broader than that and just within the context of what we're going to talk about today, what do we mean by paternalism?
Great. So paternalism, as I understand it, typically involves some kind of mechanism, either coercion or manipulation, that the aim of paternalism is to usually prevent somebody from harming themselves, perhaps in ways they're not aware of, perhaps in ways that they are aware of. So the traditional sort of notions of paternalism, typically like laws about mandatory seatbelt laws or mandatory helmet laws, maybe drug laws, at least the paternal intent is to keep people from acting in ways that will be harmful to themselves. So that's sort of the broader notion. Usually what people understand by paternalism is a coercive aspect. Sometimes people talk about paternalism in an even broader sense where they mean like if you're just trying to persuade somebody, you're trying to talk them into doing something that they otherwise wouldn't do. But it usually involves something like coercion. And in the case of libertarian paternalism, I'm going to argue in many cases it involves manipulation if not coercion.
So the libertarian factor though, you have obviously this sort of seemingly oxymoronic thing, libertarian paternalism. You're trying to keep someone from hurting themselves but through libertarian means.
Yeah, right. So the promise of libertarian paternalism is that you can sort of influence the – you can arrange the choice architecture, sort of the frame in which people make choices and make decisions and act on those without taking away – without forbidding any options, without taking away their freedom of choice. So one understanding, sort of the maybe main plank of understanding coercion is that you're restricting freedom of choice. But with libertarian paternalism, the idea is that, well, people have the right to opt out of the particular, say, nudge or intervention into the choice architecture. But the idea is that usually you're looking to exploit one of their heuristics to get them to maybe act in a particular way. So a common example of a libertarian paternalistic intervention would be, say, the default enrollment into a retirement account. So usually there's sort of studies been done where people basically if you don't if the default situation is that you are not – you have to opt into a retirement account, people don't do it, at least not initially. They just sort of go with the flow. They have status quo biases or just inertia. So if you switch the default, if you have them already sort of enrolled and they have the option to opt out, most people don't. They just remain enrolled. So
you mentioned the word nudge, which is I think an important part of this. Where does that come from?
So nudge I don't know exactly where it originated, but it's been popularized by Cass Sunstein and Richard Thaler. They had this best-selling book, Nudge, back in 2008. And the way they define nudge is very broad. It's any aspect of the choice architecture that can influence people's behavior in a predictable way without forbidding their options or significantly altering their economic incentives. But that's like a really broad sort of notion. So there's lots of different things that can be nudges. It can be self-imposed or imposed by somebody else. It doesn't even have to be imposed by a person. It can be sort of just a feature of the environment in which you're making decisions. So and this may come up in our discussion, but nudges can mean sort of just a wide variety of different kinds of things. Some of them which I think are innocuous, other things which I think might be more problematic when it comes from concerns about either autonomy or sort of respect for people's preferences.
Your retirement account example of we just start by the person contributing to retirement account and then they can opt out if they want to. That's something that's happening at the level of the employee-employer relationship. But is this – is this paternalism a theory about government? Because libertarianism is generally seen as political philosophy about the proper role of the state. So these things that would happen, the state is going to set up this choice architecture?
Yeah. So the way Sunstein and Thaler defend it, it depends. A lot of times there seems to be some kind of perhaps a government requirement in the background. So maybe governments require employers to nudge people in this way, make this make enrollment the default option. But nudging can just refer to purely private institutional mechanisms as well. It doesn't necessarily have to involve some kind of government government role.
When you talk about the choice architecture, a lot of things that I think about when I think about Nudge, you, and Thaler and Sunstein talk about this stuff, just designing a supermarket shelf, for example, right? So you want people to buy more healthy food, so you put the healthy food at eye level.
Right.
And on the other side, the business was putting maybe junk food there, but mm-hmm. something has to be at eye level.
Yeah.
So why not be healthy food, and that's better for everyone? That's a large part of the idea, right?
Right, and so that's one of the main defenses that Sunstein and Thaler often give is they say, well, look, it's unavoidable that we're going to have to, you know, you have to put food somewhere, right? You're going to have to arrange the choice architecture in some way, so you might as well do it in a way that is more welfare conducive for the target agent. So that's oftentimes a defense they will give for doing so. Yeah.
Are they slipping in – I mean, so they're calling it libertarian paternalism because they say all we're doing is influencing the choice architecture, but we're leaving people's choices open. But what you're describing doesn't sound like that. It sounds like instead they just have pushed the coercion back a step, because presumably the – say the guy organizing the supermarket shelves, if he was putting junk food up top as opposed to on the bottom, had a reason for doing that. I mean, people don't tend to organize their supermarkets just totally randomly. They did it because maybe that sells better or whatever other reason. So we are restricting someone's choice and we are using coercion to do it. We're restricting the grocer's choice to organize his store the way he'd like to.
Yeah, no, that's definitely something that that's something that could be a possibility in terms where is the level of coercion going on here. I think what Sunstein and Thaler are coming from, though, they're focusing more upon what is happening to the consumer, the target agent. So what you're doing to maybe either require or entice the vendor to act in a certain way, I think it just sort of falls by the wayside in their discussion. They focus more upon the interaction between the vendor and the customer.
It seems like the possible results of this could be incredibly beneficial, though, right? It might be marginal, right? It might just be 5% more purchasing of vegetables, but that could save us millions of dollars a year in healthcare costs. It might be 10% more savings for retirement funds, but that could save us another $1 million and make people happier in the future. With a bunch of little nudges, you could really make the world a happier place.
From the standpoint of what saves costs, perhaps I think the jury's still out on that empirical element of it. They're all. On the other hand, there's the concern about, well, what if people, in fact, this is not what actually reflects their preferences? So if we're talking about – let me backtrack a little bit. So a lot of times defenders of libertarian paternalism will say all we're trying to do is to nudge people in accordance with what their own preferences are. We're not trying to impose some kind of particular value on them. But at the same time using these sort of insights from behavioral economics, a lot of the defenders of libertarian paternalism will say, well, people have indeterminate preferences. So what we're going to try to do is then intervene in a way that will be in accordance with what we presume their preferences would truly be if they weren't sort of beset by some of these irrational biases or these heuristics that lead them astray. But the concern here is that we're actually perhaps overlooking what it is that people prefer as opposed to using these sort of proxies like health or wealth as stand-ins. So to say that people might benefit from it, well, maybe from a cost-saving standpoint perhaps if nudges cause people to act in healthier manners, I think that's an empirical matter. There's nothing I can really answer there from the armchair. But the question is, if we're really respecting people's preferences, we can't just assume that people want to act, you know, in the so-called healthier way or in the way that saves them more money. If in fact the choice architecture is leading them to just sort of go with the flow and react in ways that they're not even aware of. And so there's the well-being aspect, but there on the other hand, there's also the concern with whether we're respecting their autonomy at the same time.
It sounds almost like a quantum mechanics theory of preferences. It's like they're indeterminate until they're they're observed or looked at in some way and then they coalesce around something. So all we're trying to do is to make them coalesce around different things.
Yeah, yeah. And I think that's a really interesting way of putting it. I kind of think that's how we are though a lot of times. And if the behavioral economics literature is correct, that seems to be the case, that we are not these we're not homo economicus. We're not these sort of beings with this well-ordered set of stable ex-ante preferences that sustain across time. I mean, we have to have some set of stable preferences to have sort of a coherent self on some minimal level. But to say that I know precisely or I should know precisely what my preferences are with regard to what I'm having for dessert tonight, it just doesn't seem like that's how we are. I mean, we are boundedly rational for a good reason. Our heuristics are time savers and resource savers because we don't have the capacity to we don't have infinite processing ability. So the concern with maybe arranging choice architecture to steer people in certain ways is that we're in fact it's somebody else's will or intention that's being imposed upon people without them even being aware of it.
But we can ask people about their preferences, right? Mm-hmm. And we'll find a fair amount of agreement on a lot of these things. So you look at the New Year's resolutions that people make and it's always I want to lose weight, I want to exercise more, I want all these aspirational things. And so if you were to ask people, I think, would you like to eat healthier than you do right now? Most people, nearly all people would probably say yes and they would mean it. And so what I'm wondering is can we decouple – because it seems to me like if I'm understanding you correctly, you're saying well they can say that but their preferences in the moment when they're actually going to pick from the top shelf or the bottom shelf, the junk food or the vegetables may change. We can't know their preferences until they actually express them in this quantum mechanics thing that Trevor did. But it seems like – is it possible to say, well, they can have a preference, but they don't have the capacity to say act on it? Like so the Greeks had this wonderful word akrasia, which was you act against your own. You want something, but you lack the willpower to act the way that you actually want to act, which is something that all of us have experienced.
Yes.
And so we could say we do know their preferences. They actually do want the vegetables, but when they go to the store, they're weak-willed and their urge for chocolate takes over. So therefore, we're not really stepping on their preferences. We're in fact helping them realize their actual preferences.
Well, that could be that certainly can be the case. I don't want to deny the existence of akrasia. But what can be ambiguous in that regard is whether at some point with regard to hyperbolic discounting, for instance, people can have sort of intertemporal changes to their how they discount the future. So yeah, akrasia is certainly a possibility, but in some cases, it may be that somebody rationally changes their mind. They say, "I'm not going to have dessert tonight." And then when they see the tiramisu, they decide, "I'm going to have it after all." So it may be ambiguous even to them whether in fact this is an akrasic moment or a kratic moment or a moment where they are rationally changing their mind about their short-term preferences and the trade-offs maybe with regard to the future. But then there's an added layer of complication because if somebody does that often enough, you say, okay, well, let's say this guy, he's always saying like I need to lose weight. I need to exercise. I'm going to not have dessert tonight. But always does otherwise, then there's some question about whether the stated preferences are actually his genuine preferences or his actions are revealing his preferences. So there's all of these informational constraints that I think complicate matters to the point where it's unclear in many instances whether in fact some given, say, intervention is really tracking a significant number of people's preferences if in fact their actions speak louder than what they're stating.
And of course, economics has its own theory about how to discover people's preferences, namely what you do is a revelation of a revealed preference.
Yeah.
One of my favorite economics jokes is the two economists who see a Porsche and one of them says, "I want that," and the other one says, "Obviously not." Because just wanting something is not a preference. You need to be able to act on it and then it reveals your preferences. Yeah. Now, is that problematic as a theory of preferences?
Well, I mean, I don't want to see. On the one hand, I don't want to say that just whatever it is that you do reveals what you must want to do in that moment. Because, like, okay, well, I just decide randomly I want to jump off a ledge. It must be what I wanted to do at that moment. I mean, that's sort of just then making rationality tautological. It's just whatever you do is whatever you do. So I don't really want to go down that rabbit hole. But at the same time, I think it makes sense to have conceptual space to say, well, maybe sometimes somebody's being weak-willed, being acratic. Maybe sometimes they're rationally changing their mind, and maybe sometimes their actions are revealing what they really prefer as opposed to what they say they want. That cheap talk is a thing. So I think all of those things – you can have space for all of those things without saying that okay, well, you know, it's just your actions just reveal what it is you really want moment to moment. So you know, I know that maybe sounds like a cop-out, but I think that the fact that all of those options, all those possibilities make sense, reveal the fact that there may be informational constraints on our ability to recognize our own, let alone other people's preferences, understood subjectively, their well-being understood subjectively. And so I think it complicates the question as to whether in fact libertarian paternalism is really paternalistic in terms of serving their well-being. You can't just assume that making somebody influencing somebody to make healthier or choices or more wealth conducive choices is in fact all things considered in alignment with what they understand their well-being to be in some reasonable way. So
wouldn't the person who is choosing, say, rationally to have the extra dessert or to buy the junk food at the grocery store, I mean, in this libertarian paternalism setup that you've given us, where we are just kind of deciding the order that the choices that are presented to them and how they're presented to them, but we're not cutting off any particular choices, then that person who rationally wants dessert and means to have it, all they have to do is bend down to the bottom shelf and pick it up. So we haven't really – I mean, what problem have we caused? We haven't cut off their autonomy in any meaningful sense. But it does seem like we've helped the person who – just through weakness of the will, because that bending down is an extra step and maybe it offsets the weakness of the will a little bit, and they're better off. So I don't – I guess I'm not seeing exactly in this example we're talking about here how this causes problems, how this limits the autonomy of the people who are choosing rationally.
Yeah. Okay. So one way of thinking about it is that people may often wish one of the main concerns that I raise with regard to arranging choice architecture is the fact that if the effectiveness of the nudge relies upon its covertness, the fact that it's maybe going on behind the person's back, I think that is a potential worry in terms of compromising their autonomy, if not undermining it, because what you're really doing in this situation is saying, okay, well, the person can't be trusted as a decision maker. They can't be trusted to decide whether or not they're going to make this, maybe by their own lights, rational or irrational decision. So if I am, you know, if I go to a, you know, if I'm in a cafeteria and unbeknownst to me, the choice architect is sort of hiding the desserts, and maybe I really don't, you know, I'm weak-willed. I don't want to have the desserts. But maybe as an autonomous chooser, I want to be at least tempted and make the decision myself whether or not I'm going to have the dessert. I think that what raises a worry here is that if it's going on behind my back, I'm not really being treated as an autonomous decision maker. I'm being treated more as somebody who hopefully can be steered one way or the other, and maybe, you know, maybe that's beneficial to me, but there's still cost in terms of respecting me as an autonomous decision maker.
That's interesting because in child situations with actual children, with people who aren't full fledged adult citizens, there will be situations where you say, you know, well, don't let her see it, because if she sees it, she's going to want it.
Yeah.
So we're going to surreptitiously like hide the thing, whatever it is, a toy or a candy or something like that, because if she sees it, she's going to yell and scream about it, and that seems treating them like a child. And if the government's doing that, if they don't even tell you that they're doing this, if they're just saying, well, no, this is now where the tiramisu is now on the bottom.
Yeah.
We haven't done anything, then it seems to treat you like a child.
Yeah. I mean, and like, it could be that maybe I'm overstating this. Maybe my worries would go away if there were just like a sign or a placard that said, here's why we're hiding the tiramisu here. But I think that making the nudge overt in that way in many situations would actually undermine its effectiveness. And so I think there's the worries arise when the defender of a particular nudge is sort of counting on people not to notice what's happening. There seems something screwy about that, I think, at least.
It's interesting though, because it makes me think about businesses who are nudging us too all the time.
Yeah.
And we kind of expect for it to be happening. The best example I think is Netflix. Netflix is constantly tracking so much data about what we actually do and then putting something up right next to it because they have some correlation that shows there. And is it better or worse that Netflix does that? I mean, do we know that they're doing that so it's not as big of a problem?
Yeah.
If government's doing
you're it? Right. It's a complicated question. I'm somebody who I as long as there's sort of somebody intentionally trying to steer you in a way where they're counting upon your inattentiveness, I think there's at least a morally problematic thing going on there. Maybe it's ultimately justifiable. Maybe contextual as far as your awareness that something's going on and then you're willing to still engage in the practice. So it is a complicated matter. I don't want to say, well, okay, it's bad if governments do it, but it's okay if private institutions do it because the Netflix example, there's some evidence that certain colors in certain brand logos encourage people to purchase more. Well, if you kind of know this is going on, maybe it's okay then because you're just willing to take the risk that you're going to be nudged in particular ways. But I imagine that in a lot of situations like Netflix maybe doesn't necessarily want you to know what they're doing. And I think that's sort of points to the worry that's going on as far as what may be compromising your autonomy. Now, what to do about it? I'm a philosopher. Maybe just wag your finger and say that's wrong. Don't stop doing that or boycott it if you don't like it or whatever. I don't really know where to go from there other than I'll be satisfied if I can sort of point out some wrong-making features of why that's going on. But I don't want to just say okay, well, since private institutions are doing it anyway, it's always okay. If people don't know what's going on, and then they're not necessarily making an informed decision to assume that risk. So
what Netflix is doing is when we're talking about in the context of Netflix or other online internet things, we call it filtering, right? Like it's filtering what we're seeing and based on some set of criteria. And it occurs to me that even within the context of private filtering, there are certain kinds of filtering that we seem to think are perfectly fine. Like people don't tend to get upset at Netflix for showing you a certain set of movies except for when it obviously screws up and shows you totally weird things. And then we just laugh at it. We're not mad at it.
Yeah.
But there are other instances of filtering where we do get mad, right? Like the Facebook stuff. Like people are always Facebook is hiding things that I want to see and instead people are – the advertisers, they're showing me things that like they think advertisers are paying them for and you can pay to boost your exposure on Facebook and that makes us really mad. And I'm wondering – it seems like one thing that might distinguish these and might play into a problem with government doing this too is if we – I mean we – so let's go back to the grocery store example real quick. It seems less problematic if what we did with the grocery store example or other types of nudging was we asked you at a certain time, what are your preferences? Like do you want to lose weight? And then we set up filters in the grocery store to kind of help you along with that. So yes, you want to eat more vegetables, so we're going to put the vegetables in a more accessible spot. That would be less troubling.
Or those crazy websites where you write a check to some organization that you hate,
like
the NRA. Right. And if you don't lose 50 pounds, then they send that check to the NRA.
But what's going on there is that it's personalized filtering, right? Like it's your preferences being kind of re-expressed to you in a new way, which is kind of what goes on with the Netflix thing, right? Like it's based on what you've watched and it's personalized to you. Whereas what makes us mad at Facebook is it's non-personalized. It's representing the interests of another person.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it feels like a lot of the problem with a government-based paternalism is it's not really going to be representing our own interests, right? It's either because it's just experts who think they can choose for us and for kind of epistemic humility reasons, like they're not going to do a good job of it, or government is so beholden to special interests that want to promote their own interests at the expense of us that it may actually really be promoting their interests.
Yeah. No, I think that's right. I think that a lot of times what happens is that even if the intention of the choice architect is to influence people in a way that the choice architect thinks people really prefer, what ends up happening is that you have proxies like well, make the nudge in alignment with what will influence people to make health, objectively healthier choices or objectively more wealth promoting choices. And that sort of papers over, I think, the complexity of the different trade-off rates of people's schedule values in their conception of the good, because there's like a lot of different things that maybe I'm willing to trade off some level of health. Maybe it helps me going out to the bar with my friends, companionship or autonomy or just pleasure, things like that. That sort of there's not really a way that you can have a sort of a default setting with regard to that. It just becomes health or wealth becomes the proxy setting that the anchors on which the choice architects can use their own particular motivation for saying, well, this is really what people probably want.
So right? It seems pretty disingenuous then. Kind of got to the point that it's disingenuous to call it libertarian paternalism in that sense, because some sort of coercion, as Aaron pointed out, and some sort of other problems of government just constraining your choices like it's done before, but making it less clear.
Yeah, I mean, I try to be as charitable as I can and say, I'll put it this way. I have a working paper right now that's rather cheekily titled "Libertarian Paternalism is Neither Libertarian nor Paternalistic." So that's the uncharitable sort of. That's the in your face uncharitable title, and then I immediately backtrack a little bit and say, well, the intention here, I think, is genuinely. I think Sunstein and Thaler genuinely think that they're trying to, they're preserving people's choices with regard to nudges. But the worry here is that, well, do you really have the freedom to opt out of a nudge if you don't know that it's happening, right? If you're counting on sort of somebody's inattentiveness in order to influence them to act in a healthier way, then if they're not even aware of the opportunity to opt out, it doesn't really seem like strictly speaking, there is the freedom to opt out. But as a matter of practical rationality, are they aware of that? Do they have that freedom to opt out if they're not aware of it? So it depends upon what angle you take. Like maybe metaphysically speaking, it is libertarian because you're not actually removing their freedom of choice as you would be through, say, a directly coercive mechanism. But if they're not aware of what's going on, then it's not clear to me that it really is a matter of preserving their freedom, because if it's not coercive, it's at least manipulative.
It also seems like you'd have to almost assert – well, you wouldn't have to almost assert, but you'd have to play with the idea of whether or not it could ever be rational to be fat or to smoke, right, or to skydive, things that could create social cost. And if you don't leave that up to a person, an individual person, then you say, well, this actually that person got so much pleasure out of food that they got way more pleasure than the cost of them being fat. So
it doesn't seem too far away to say, okay, there could be really liking food, becoming obese. Somebody can say, I really like that. The obesity is the cost I'm willing to pay for my indulgence. People may really like smoking. I as an ex-smoker, I used to really like smoking, and I quit smoking for various reasons. But I can think it wasn't insane of me to make those decisions. It wasn't irrational. Maybe I'm rationalizing what I did, but it didn't seem clearly to be something that I really didn't want to do at the time. So I think it's easy to say, well, of course, the healthier choice is what people should prefer if they had these, unlimited processing abilities and unlimited information and things like that. But that's making normative assumptions in the place of assuming that we should be rational in some kind of really idealized sense.
But what about cost to others? Because a lot of the choices that we make have cost to others, and so we cut them off. So drunk driving, right? You might say, well, I happen to get a lot of pleasure out of drunk driving. Mm-hmm. And we say, well, so what? The damages that you would potentially do.
Absolutely.
And so a lot of these things we're talking about, like healthy eating or retirement accounts, part of the argument for them is not like, well, you're going to hurt yourself.
Yeah.
It's we're going to have to bear the costs
right.
for you making these poor decisions. So we should have some say over
right,
what you get
right.
to
do. And actually that's sort of – I think a lot of that is going on in the background either with Sunstein and Thaler or with other defenders or Mayor Bloomberg during his tenure. It was often a pecuniary externality argument. That's a mouthful to say. But sort of the notion that people's unhealthy decisions either is going to raise other people's insurance rates, or if there's some kind of public safety net, then that's going to raise costs for other people. So that's, you know, that's a whole angle. That's an interesting angle. I'm not going into that in this paper that I'm working on right now, but I think that's an important question. The easy way out, the hand wavy approach is to say, well, ultimately that sort of safety net is itself a paternalistic motivation. So somebody who says, well, we're not really making a paternalistic argument when we say we should nudge people or coerce them in order to save taxpayer money or what have you. I think ultimately, well, why is there that safety net beyond just maybe what's a matter of person's own there can be safety nets to help people for reasons that they didn't have control over, beyond that's not a matter of their own culpability. But if the safety net's extended to include people's culpable choices, then that's ultimately, I think, maybe a question begging argument on the part of the paternalist, because the argument is, well, we have to save people from themselves, and so we should restrict their liberties in order to keep them from making us pay for them in the long run. I don't know if that came out clearly.
You're making a point about culpability in general, because this is a conversation we've been having both politically and then in the psychology community, everything for hundreds of years now, but especially in the 20th century and the early part of the 21st century, this question of what are you culpable for? And a lot of studies have been put into claims that obesity is an addiction, that beating your wife is an addiction, making these defenses in criminal matters, and all these. They seem very tied to having a safety net, because as soon as there's a safety net, people could be predating off of it. And so one way you say, well, he's obese and he could be predating off the healthcare system, but obesity is a condition, not a choice. And then all of a sudden, it's just paternalism all over again. But you're not making choices, so we're not actually taking away choices because your obesity wasn't a choice in the first place.
Yeah, and I mean, I'm from the armchair. I can't really speak to that. I mean, I'm willing to bite the bullet if it turns out that our best theory of addiction is that it's not your choice in any meaningful sense. Then I'm willing to say that. Okay, then that's a realm that's not a matter of autonomy. It's a matter of something that maybe is like a disease or something along those lines. I know personally, I'm not ready to buy into that view just yet. I think it's easy to just say the devil made me do it, but that's me from the armchair. So again, if the best theory of addiction says people can't help the way they act, then. I'll have to go with it. Yeah.
But do we have to define autonomy now? Is the burden on us to define what an autonomous choice is? With all the pressures to say that there isn't such thing as an autonomous choice.
And so what complicates matters as well is that I've been talking about autonomy sort of in terms of free choice, which I think is one view of autonomy or one aspect of it, but I don't necessarily think that exhausts the conception of autonomy one can have. I mean, another view of autonomy, not inconsistent with one that has to do with freedom of choice, is that well maybe it's somewhat inconsistent, but it could say, well, even if free choice is somehow a myth or what have you, there's a distinction between being, say, necessitated by one's own internal preferences or psychological elements and being controlled by an external sort of for someone else's will. So even if my own choices are necessitated by my own sort of inner psychology, that could still be a matter of authenticity, a matter of autonomy in this sort of restricted, maybe compatibilist sense, if you will, that people may prefer to have as opposed to being controlled either overtly or unwittingly by somebody else's exercise of will. So even if free choice is a myth, I think that there's still a notion of autonomy out there that it can be used as a potential defeater of a lot of these arguments for why we should have a wide array of intentional choice architecture. So
if the voters choose the libertarian paternalist route, and so they're choosing it in advance, is that an exercise of autonomy? Because so they're binding themselves in the same way that Odysseus having his sailors tie him to the mast, we wouldn't say that then once he was tied to the mast and wanted to be free, he had lost autonomy because he actually had said in advance, I'm going to want to get away, but I really shouldn't, and you need to tie me up. So the voter is doing the same thing. The voters read the Sunstein book and say, yeah, that sounds pretty good. I want to vote for people who are going to urge me to eat healthily, no matter what my future self happens to say.
Well, if it's a unanimous vote, then yeah, I think that's perfectly fine. But that there's the whole problem with democracy, right? It's those people who, you know, the majority of people who don't vote at all, or you know, even if there is 100% turnout, the minority on that side of the issue then isn't necessarily autonomous in any meaningful sense. At least, so I think.
Well, they're not. You could vote. You could say I'm just voting to impose this on myself. Which you said going back in that kind of self-choiced architecture has autonomy to it, like writing a check to a political organization you hate and if you don't lose weight.
Yeah.
You, that's tying yourself to the mast in some way, right?
Yeah. But really in the process you're tying other people to the mast as well,
exactly.
Maybe without them signing onto it.
Yeah. So voting is also – and that's of course goes back to the cost thing. Well, these healthcare costs are becoming a problem.
Yeah.
These retirement account costs, the poor old people, whatever, people who don't save for retirement, they're becoming a problem. And that's the other argument that comes into play. If you think about what Social Security was argued for when it was first passed, it was unwise older people who weren't saving for their retirement. Mm-hmm. Now we argue for empowering people like we at the Cato Institute and libertarians arguing to empower people to save for their own retirement, but there still will be someone who doesn't do it. So in terms of trying to catch that person who falls through the cracks, is libertarian paternalism preferable to the straight Social Security exaction?
Yeah. I mean that's a tough question as far as what maybe is empirically the best policy approach. I mean I'm kind of a diet libertarian when it comes to this. I'm somewhat sympathetic to like a universal basic income, unconditional basic income. That I think, you know, at the very least, you can. If I'm not opposed to that in principle. Maybe it doesn't work. Maybe there's all kinds of reasons to think it doesn't work. But I think that if it comes down to a trade-off between like any erosion of personal liberties versus a safety net, I kind of I incline toward the liberties. If the safety net requires us to have all these conditions on what people do, like you need to get permission to order a pizza, when it gets to that point, if it already isn't in some degree to that point, then I think that's what raises all kinds of worries. So yeah, I mean, and what's empirically the best way to go about that? I'm not sure, but as far as libertarian paternalism versus Social Security. I don't like either of those options, to be honest.
Well,
is there a third way?
We didn't even bring up the slippery slope because that's what you just brought. And the slippery slope here is huge. The slippery slope for Social Security is, I guess, more people having it and the check being bigger. The slippery slope for endorsing libertarian paternalism is Brave New World Demolition Man.
In principle would not be a potential pecuniary externality? Like, you don't exercise enough. Get up, right? I mean, and maybe that's facile to say, but there's nothing in principle that would prevent there being all kinds of added restrictions to what people can do in the name of protecting them for giving them a protection that maybe they would rather opt out of.
Well,
talking about opting out, right?
Yeah.
And that slippery slope seems particularly slippery if you're right that the libertarian paternalists aren't really thinking about the restrictions on the providers but instead just the consumers,
mm-hmm.
because we don't tend to think of a lack of – like if choices don't exist, it's not a restriction on my autonomy, right? So we don't like – it's – I would love it if
– You could fly.
If I could fly or if there were some company out there that was providing me with this imaginary product that I think would be totally awesome. But the fact that there isn't that company isn't like a restriction on my autonomy.
Mm-hmm.
The lack of the iPhone 7
is not a restriction. If we aren't considering it coercion, we're not considering it a problem to restrict what the providers can provide, right? So we by saying you have to order your shelf in this way or you can't – you can't do the huge sodas as a libertarian paternalist thing because then people won't buy them. Then that seems to open us up to pretty much restricting everything because everything we get comes from providers to mm-hmm. some degree.
Yeah. No, I agree.
And of course the slippery slope problem is particularly pronounced when there is no limiting principle. If the principle they're articulating can be applied to anything going forward and at no point will they be like, well, no, stop. This is – too far. You're meddling too much in people's lives and people's choices. And there's nothing about libertarian paternalism exactly that would have that happen.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, so there's some really good articles on this by Mario Rizzo and Glenn Whitman about sort of the institutional sort of public choicey kinds of arguments about, well, you know, even if Sunstein and Thaler, we take them at their word that, hey, we're just trying to have this sort of fairly moderate, gentle set of nudges. They're not the ones necessarily they're not the policymakers. They're not the voters. They're not the bureaucrats who are enforcing these mechanisms. And so once you have that, those people in control of making these kinds of decisions, there's possibly a lack of accountability. There's not necessarily a concern on the part of those people that what they're doing is still respectful enough of people's freedom of choice.
And there's lack of the possibility of abusing it in a specific way that government abuses things, particularly in the big soda instance in New York City.
Yeah.
You know, everyone was always saying, well, why didn't you attack Starbucks drinks that are five times the calories? And it seemed like the answer to that question was because poor people drink soda and soda is on the outs right now for people who are more well-to-do, and more well-to-do people make laws and they are more likely to go to Starbucks and get a caramel, double macchiato, whatever, and less likely to get a big gulp. And now you just have pure self-interest becoming part of the choice architecture system, and that's the exact kind of danger we should be concerned with as libertarians.
I agree as well. I mean, I don't necessarily go into these arguments in what I'm working on because I think other people have made them better than I really have anything to add to. But yeah, I think that as far as just a practical policy matter, that's definitely a concern. My focus is upstream of that. You know, even if somehow we could magically implement these in ways that are would not be befall a potential for abuse or slippery slopes, I still think there's worries upstream about what is it that we're doing now, these so-called moderate gentle nudges in terms of, in fact, are they actually respecting people's autonomy? Are they genuinely tracking people's well-being? And it's the verdict's far from clear in those regards. So
you've defined paternalism and libertarian paternalism and said it's bad, and you've talked about it as this, we're organizing the choice architecture. We're saying which choices are on the table or what order you can approach them in. We can make some choices easier to access than others, and that's cutting off people's autonomy. But isn't that what libertarianism itself is? Like we're saying, there are certain things, like you might want to choose a state that can do these things, but you can't.
Yeah.
And you might want to wander around gathering up this property, but you can't because we've cordoned it off as private property in these certain ways, and we've set up all these rules, and you can't choose these things. And on top of that, trust us, you'll be better off with these things than if you didn't have them.
That's a good question, and this is going to maybe sound like hand waving here, but I don't think that there's anything wrong per se with coercion. I don't think there's anything wrong per se with manipulation. I sort of take a what's so called justificatory liberal approach, that our liberal polity that employs coercion, which I think inevitably we do, and perhaps employs manipulation. These things are not per se bad. Some people, I think, view coercion or manipulation as inherently pejorative. It's like, okay, well, that's coercive, therefore it's wrong. Not if it's justified. Now, what does that mean to be justified? Whole big debate about what that can involve. And then there's nothing that I'm going to be able to say here that will be satisfactory, other than something having to do with the coercion and its rationale, or the manipulation and its rationale being in alignment with the sort of the values and preferences of the people who would stand to be coerced or stand to be manipulated. That's a very broad way of approaching it. But if a libertarian polity, we can tell a story about why some particular, say, property right restriction is justified because it's better off for all of us to act that way. We can sort of help get along with each other better than some nearby alternative. Then if we can tell a story about why that's justified to everybody, even if somebody doesn't actually assent to it, but we can point out to say, well, given your values and your preferences and your beliefs, you should endorse this particular restriction. Even if it's not your favorite restriction, it's better than, say, some no agreement point. Then I think we can tell a story about why ultimately it's justified. So I don't want to say libertarian paternalism if I've come across as saying that libertarian paternalism is wrong, full stop, I want to say no. it's wrong if it's not justified to this or that particular person who is maybe unwittingly influenced by it. So some people will be perfectly – will find libertarian paternalism perfectly justified. There's a way to sort of interact with them without imposing it on those who to whom it's not justified, then that's fine. If there's some story we can tell about how a given scheme of property rights is justifiable to everybody who would be under that coercive scheme, then we can tell a story. And then
it seems we can
run with it. Yeah. Easier said than done. That's where all the devil in the details is. But
yeah, it seems that in the way you describe it there, we could almost be saying if we're trying to minimize some of these paternalism negative aspects or negative coercion, that if we want to say that property rights are paternalistic, I guess I'll grant that for some purposes. But the libertarian society should not be – government should not be something where people are just competing about who can best paternalize the other group as long as they're in power.
Yeah.
It should be something where there's more areas where you can – you can create your own paternalism for your own interests, such as you can run your household in your way that you want to and your town and your way you want to.
And especially if you need some kind of a property right in order to realize your autonomy better than some alternative like a Hobbesian anarchy or what have you, then yeah. I mean this is sort of we're not talking about idealization here. We are inherently social beings, and so the property rights are sort of demands that we make on one another to give each other space so that we can act however we choose, live our lives as we see fit. That to me I think is a precondition for autonomy rather than sort of this ex-ante paternalistic imposition. I think it's a precondition for being free from paternalism as much as possible, since we aren't these brains in a vat or these Cartesian sort of inherently atomistic beings that have no sort of – can just go about ourselves independently of one another. We wouldn't need property rights, I think, if we were perfectly atomistic and could just like be protected from one another. So
in conclusion, it seems that we've gone a lot of different directions in this conversation, but libertarian paternalism is not very libertarian. It sometimes isn't even paternalistic, and in general not a good idea.
Yes. So I think that libertarian paternalism is not typically libertarian insofar as even if it's strictly speaking preserves a person's freedom of choice, doesn't forbid them options, insofar as it counts on people not being aware of the particular intervention going on, it doesn't really reflect a respect for them as autonomous decision makers. Instead, it sort of relies upon exploiting people's cognitive biases or heuristics to steer them to act in particular ways that maybe don't reflect either their own preferences or how they would wish to be treated with regard to going about correcting their own actions in light of perhaps acrasia or other sorts of complications with regard to their preferences. It's not really paternalistic in a lot of cases insofar as we understand paternalism as a success term, insofar as we understand paternalism as actually helping people to act in alignment with their own well-being broadly construed, because I think in lots of cases people people having indeterminate preferences, it's not necessarily clear whether a particular choice architecture scheme is in alignment with what people really value, a variety of different preferences that they can have. So given the informational constraints we have with regard to whether somebody is weak-willed or whether in fact they're changing their mind or whether in fact they're just paying lip service to some particular wealth-conducive or health-conducive activity or in fact whether they value something else, there's a lot of complications there that make it, I think, it's too easy just to assume that some particular intervention is in fact genuinely conducive to a person's well-being.
Thank you for listening to Free Thoughts. If you have any questions or comments about today's show, you can find us on Twitter at Free Thoughts Pod. That's Free Thoughts, P-O-D. Free Thoughts is a project of Libertarianism.org and the Cato Institute and is produced by Evan Banks. To learn more about libertarianism, visit us on the web at www.libertarianism.org.